For a small piece of business, I've heard from about a third of you that have gotten me that Jupyter notebook and run everything. I think it shouldn't take you long. You know, install the thing and then run that existing notebook, basically. Make sure you get me to that to me by 5 o'clock tomorrow. If you're having trouble, just get in touch with me. Again, this is not meant to be a test of your installation skills, but basically just to make sure we all get it installed and are able to use it. So we're going to use it in the future. I wanted to see how far we got today in class before I posted the problems for next week. So we'll probably include at least one from the stuff we get to today, but not a huge set of problems. And again, I want to stress that the problems I'm giving you guys is kind of a minimum set of problems that you probably need to be looking at, and kind of representative of the type of problems you can expect to see. So we'll start working more examples in class now that we have at least some foundational theory. So just have that in mind as we're working forward. It's the minimum set, basically. It's probably not enough for you to really know it, working five problems every couple weeks, right? But they are representative of that. So if you're working problems on your own, which, again, was what I'm suggesting, and have questions about any of those, feel free to get in touch as well. Right. Okay. Questions about anything we have coming up, basically? So we're going to start out. We started talking about complex representations on Tuesday. Let's look back at our simple example, mass spring damper, or mass spring system here, seismically excited. And you might see a system like this, and it says, well, hey, what's the frequency response of this system? In that case, what are we looking for? What's the frequency response of a system? Oh, you guys are killing me right now. Okay. So frequency response we're looking at, we're going to assume that Y, or my inputs, are pure harmonics for the most part. This is kind of how we get there generally. And then how does the response of the system change as the frequency of the input changes? That's the frequency response. Right, those are the plots that have frequency on the horizontal axis that we've been doing. Sorry. Chalk dust. Thank you. Frequency on the horizontal axis. So the ones we've talked through the last 2.5 lectures are mostly frequency responses, right? If you ask for a time response, it's time on the horizontal axis. So time response, we're usually looking for x of t, or whatever output variable you have as a function of time. Right? We're talking frequency response, we're usually going to look at something like a transfer function and phase information. So, we want the frequency response, and if we can get the frequency response, we actually can get x of t as well. They're very much related, right? So here, let's assume y is a pure harmonic that has magnitude y bar. Okay, so how do I get to the frequency response? Yeah, I need the equations of motion, right? Frequency response are just kind of a property that falls out of that, really. Right? So I need some free body diagram. I need to write the equation of motion. This. What kind of forces do we have? Spring force. Okay, what's the spring force in this case? It's K times something. Y minus X. As I've drawn the arrow, yes. So if Y is larger than X, so I've pushed on Y farther than X has moved, right, this sign's going to be positive. I'll get a positive force. Everything works out. Okay. So we have enough already to write our equation in motion. All There we have it. Hopefully this all looks familiar. And we like to do this if we can. What's the natural frequency of this system? Square root of K over M. This is could write that equation in motion that way as well. Okay. So we've solved this. We say, hey, we saw this before. Hey, particularly for the undamped case, I know it's either going to be exactly in phase or exactly out of phase. Right, so I would assume a solution x of t is x bar sine of whatever or a sine of whatever, and then solve for that coefficient. Right. And we could do that here, and we have done that here. But let's look at how will we do this if we're going to use that complex method. We don't have to use that complex method here, but let's look at the simple example and try to understand. So in the complex, well, let's think about this first. Sine, right? If we're going to write as some kind of complex representation, what is the sine omega t? What's the relationship between writing y of t this way and writing it that way? It's the imaginary component, right? So we're going to remember that. Y of t is actually going to be the imaginary component of that. But we're going to simply work with the full complex exponential to get to the solution. So if we have a y of that form, we assume an x to match, or theta, whatever your variable of interest is. It's x in this case. Okay. I take two derivatives, right, and I just plug into my equation of motion. Okay, I got either the omega t's everywhere, that can, whoops, y doesn't go away. Those guys go away on both sides, and I want to solve for what x bar is, and I figure out that x bar square root of that. So then I know, I'm just plugging here, and I lost the y bar. There's our solution. So we have the time response in this case. It's a function of t, it's a time response. Okay. So we have an answer, right? Plot the frequency response, we just need to look at this guy, right? That's what we're plotting when we plot the frequency response. If we're looking, thinking about this as a time response, let's talk about that for just a second. What's going on here? What's wrong with this? It's imaginary, yes. So we have to figure out how to get out a real response from this complex one. Okay. What we talked about before, well, actually, x bar is actually complex itself. Right? So we said, well, we can write that as a combination of real and imaginary components, where xr, the kind of real coefficients, xi, the imaginary coefficients. Okay. In this case, what does that give us? Do we have any imaginary coefficients of x bar. Any imaginary components? No, so we have that in this case, right? Everybody see that? So we know XR is effectively what we have there, and XI is 0. So what does that do for us? Well, if we look at our response, well, e to the I omega t you know that's true. That's an I. Kind of mapped that out last time. So you end up, plug everything in, ends up being x, or try to save us. A little bit of math, just make sure I get it right. Got it all right. So we figured everything out we need to fill in the pieces here. Okay. Well, we said, well, xi is 0, so we know that term goes away, that term goes away. Okay. And so we end up with represent our response in terms of sines and cosines. Okay, now we get to look back. What was the form of our actual input? Well, the form of our actual input was the imaginary component of y bar e to the I omega t, right, which we mapped out when we started this. So if I go down here, I just need to pick off imaginary coefficient from the resulting complex x of t. So we know then end up there. Depending on how you're thinking about this, there could have been a y bar here, or I could have been looking just at that. So kind of the math works out fine either way. If you consider y bar real, it's fine. Or you keep y bar on the outside and it becomes part of that. So either way it works. But we end up with that. Does that look right? Yes, yeah, it matches, right? We did the kind of simple, we knew this was pure harmonic, we said it was either exactly in phase, out of phase, whatever, we got to that solution, not using this complex form. So that procedure we just followed is exactly the procedure you need to follow if you have something more complex than a mass. Complex in difficulty, not complex in imaginary. Some more sophisticated model, let's say, maybe. So I take my input, my actual harmonic input, if it's a pure harmonic, I need to recognize whether it's the real or imaginary part of the complex exponential form at the same frequency. Okay. Solve the problem using the complex exponential. This case, it ends up being a lot more work for us. Right? As soon as you have damping, it's not. It's a lot less work. Okay. So this case is a little bit deceptive in that way. solve using the complex exponential form, and then pick off the right coefficients matching back over here. And that's the general procedure, use that complex form. Yes, sir?
So at the end, whenever you choose the sign, is that because you choose the sign at the beginning, you assume sign?
Well, I chose sign back here.
Right.
So I knew that was the imaginary part of the complex exponential.
Okay.
So when I got over here, I didn't do it based on sine or cosine. I chose the imaginary coefficient. If this had been a cosine, right, I would have just picked off the real component, and I would have got a cosine there, right? Which that also matches what we should expect there. If I had a cosine input, I'll have a cosine output, right? We said it would exactly track it, right? Because cosine is just a real component, real coefficient. So I would pick the real part. Other questions? Let's look at problem 1.102 from your book. Okay, so we have mass, whose position is described by x. We have a spring K1 attached to ground. We have a second spring attached between y, which I can control, and x. I also have a force acting directly on mass m. Okay, so what I'd like to do is let's solve this together on the board, Newton-Euler. And I'll give you a couple minutes, then the setup Lagrangian. How about that? Okay. So, what's the first step for either one of those methods? Some free body diagram. Okay, what kind of forces do we have? I heard springs. Okay, what kind of spring forces? Well, let's just write it as force from spring 1, maybe. And force from spring 2, let's say. What else do we have? We apply force. And the way we've drawn this, we're kind of assuming it can't move vertically, right? We're doing 1 degree of freedom motion. So we can kind of ignore gravity and all that stuff, right, in those other directions. Constrain to move horizontally. Okay, what's next? Yeah, I want to probably be explicit about my coordinate system. As for most of the problems we work in here, some kind of Cartesian system. At least for now, that's all we're going to need, really, for most stuff. How many degrees of freedom does this system have?
One.
That's right. Why not two? I got two variables up here to describe motion. Can only move one dimensionally. Not quite. That's not quite the reason. What's the different kind of the difference between X and Y here? Well, the spring, yeah, but like, in terms of what they represent, not in terms of their position.
The relative position to the wall?
Maybe. Which of those do I have control over, if I want to think about it? I have control over Y. So that's why it's not a degree of freedom. I can exactly specify what Y is. Right. I have control over that. Right. And X moves in response to what I do. Okay. So Y is not a degree of freedom because it's an input affected. All right. So one degree of freedom, what makes sense to describe the system then? What variable we have here?
X,
yeah. So one degree of freedom, one equation of motion, one generalized coordinate. Okay. So some of the forces we have minus force spring one plus positive force spring two plus the applied force. Okay, what's the first spring force? Magnitude of that guy. It's K delta, right? Well, delta in this case, if we've, in particular the way we've drawn an X, said, hey, at X equals zero, it's at equilibrium, so it's just K or K1X. Okay. Similarly, spring two, spring constant two times the deflection of that second spring. Okay, so we have K2 times something. K2, we have a vote for Y minus X. Why are you saying Y minus X? We have X minus Y. Based on how I've drawn it here, which way should it be? Y minus X. I think so. Is there anybody that agrees want to explain? Well, we have to match up the sign here with what I've drawn in the free body diagram. Because the direction of the arrow there is embedded in these signs. Okay. So if I'm going to get a positive force, right, this needs to be positive in amplitude when Y is greater than X. I could just as easily have drawn this the other way, and then I would need negative amplitude when that's true. Okay, well, that flips the order there, and I get those two negative signs and then cancel each other out. So what order you pick here depends on how you're drawing the arrows in your free body diagram. Like we talked about this a couple weeks ago. Right, so same thing here. All right, you just have to match this ordering so that the sign of the magnitude term fits with the sign that you've chosen based on how you drew your arrows in the free body diagram. And again, you have that choice. My general method, if you want to borrow it, for springs that are attached to ground, I'll displace the mass and see, or whatever they're connected to, the point they're connected to, and then draw the force, what force will result from that. Springs that are connected to inputs, like this case, I hold the mass I'm worried about stationary and pull on the input and draw the arrow of what force would result from that. That's just kind of how I keep that organized. Okay, so pretty much everything I need. Okay, like terms. OK, Okay, and then I can, of course, divide by M if I want. There we have it. Equation of motion. What's the natural frequency? Right. Yeah, it's just the coefficient of that term. Right. So that's my getting square. In this case, we don't get that same simplification on the right-hand side like we did before. Yes, sir.
Could you have put the springs originally in parallel, like the equivalent spring, and then done the equations of motion with that?
That's a little bit harder here because they're not actually in parallel. Like this end can move over here. Right. This guy's fixed.
Oh, okay.
Right, so they're not, strictly speaking, in parallel then. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, if this end is fixed, though,
you can do that.
Okay, so there's Newton-Euler, pretty straightforward, I think. And just to give you a little bit of a heads up, this is a problem, I think we'll see in a minute. It probably does take a little bit longer to do with Lagrange, actually, right? Because one, it's missing, this problem doesn't have constraint forces we need to worry about. All the things that make Lagrange more efficient for some problems than Newton-Euler, those things don't exist here. So, but I think still worthwhile to look at the same problem both ways. So let's do the 145 maybe by this clock, which is wrong as usual. Take it, try to set it up and get towards this answer using the Lagrange. And then we'll come back together and walk through the steps of that at least. Give you an immediate feedback on what you're understanding. Okay. So we're going to solve this using the Lagrange's method. Where do we start? Well, we would have started back over here with the free body diagram and coordinates. We got all that taken care of. What's next then?
Energies.
Kind of start with kinetic energy. It's the total kinetic energy of the system.
1/2 mx dot squared.
I agree with that. Okay. That's the kinetic energy taken care of. That was easy. What kind of potential energy do we have?
Spring.
We have two springs we're going to have to take care of here, right? So we're going to have we can write them as squares because we know they're in one dimension. Right? Remember, that could be a vector, and you need to take care of both dimensions.
How do you know you can add them like that?
That's how energy works.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, that's a little bit of a glib answer, but that's the truth, really. Same thing would be true if you had multiple bodies here, like we did before. Right? If you're writing the total kinetic energy of the system, those things just add up.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so then we need to figure out, you know, to fit this equation, what's delta 1, what's delta 2? So delta 1 in this case is what? It's just x. What's delta 2? Y minus x. So then we have our Lagrangian, right? Just T minus V. One common mistake here, I still do it all the time, is to not make sure that negative sign gets to all the terms on potential. Kind of just a bookkeeping error, but it's a common one. So that's why I will always do this step explicitly to make sure I'm getting it everywhere I need to. Okay, I have my Lagrangian. What's next?
Partial with respect to x dot.
Perhaps. So we're going to need, if we only have x dot, right? So you guys are wanting me to start there. Do we have any external forces?
Yes.
Yeah, so that means Q1 is not going to be 0 in this case. So yeah, we could go ahead and do the intermediate math if we wanted to now, but we're going to have to get to Q1 no matter what. So let's do that. That's kind of some actual analysis. The math part, you guys can do, I trust. Okay, so how do we get to what that generalized force is? These are that virtual work stuff, okay? And we know that kind of the virtual work if we have just forces and no torques, looks something like that, if we remember, right? So we have I different forces acting at our I different places, right? It's just force times displacement, if you're thinking in terms of high school physics, right? So our force here, we need to figure out the vector form of that guy. What's our applied force? F in what direction? X. So we have in the I direction, and we need to dot that with the virtual displacement of the point at which it's being applied. Okay. Yeah, in this case, that's pretty easy, right? It's just x, right? The virtual displacement of this point, we can describe just as virtual displacement of x, and that, of course, is in the I direction too, because everything in this problem is working in that I direction. Okay. So we know then the virtual work, F delta x. What does that also equal to give us the Q1? Yeah, right. So we know that's going to be Q1 delta small Q1, which we only have one coordinate, so that's delta x. So what does that tell us that Q1 is? F, right. Does that make sense physically? Yeah, it does, right? So we talked about those generalized forces being kind of the component of that force that's causing motion in the direction of that generalized coordinate. Well, we could think about, F is directly applying, causing motion in the x direction. Works out fine for us. So that ends up over here. And then from there, it's just math. Math's in the notes. I don't think we need to do it in class. Guys can take derivatives, right? Okay. It's in the notes if you need a review. Spoiler, we get to this exact equation. And we better. Okay. So like I said, this is one problem that, a lot of the advantages of Lagrange aren't showing up here at all in terms of being able to ignore constraint and forces and those things. So if I saw this, I'm probably going to use Newton-Euler. Okay. Questions? No questions? All right. I'm going to start over here so we have room to draw some plots. So far, we've looked at harmonic inputs, either position or seismic, as your book calls those type of inputs, or direct force, without damping. And then last time, we looked at harmonic inputs with direct force for systems that have damping. Okay, so let's finish out expanding a kind of understanding of harmonic inputs for systems. We're going to look at seismic inputs or position inputs that now have damping. We haven't looked at that yet. So what does that mean? What does that model look like? It's basically this one. Oh, this is the simplest one for us to get to, basically. I have some position input, in this case y, through a spring and damper to my mass m, whose position is described by x. Are those two systems any different? Okay. That would be maybe one thing to think about. Okay, so maybe if there's some gravity, right, my orientation changed, the effects of gravity might change. Does it show up here in our analysis of the vibration of these two systems? Yeah, Y is an input still. So does gravity show up if you look at that right-hand system? You guys are saying yes? Wrong. Talked about this on like day two. Right, we looked at, because I'm describing this from some equilibrium position, right, those gravity terms drop out. Those drop out because I can take out this kind of static, excuse me, jeez. I can take out the static contribution of the force to balance gravity, and then all I have is vibration around that point. Right? And I kind of indicated that by saying, hey, I'm measuring x from its equilibrium place. So these two are equivalent. And I wanted to show that because an example we're going to talk about in a minute, but also if you look at this, you start to see why the book calls it a seismic input. This is a model of a building. Really simple model of a building. But it's a model of a building. Right? If I have an earthquake, I have seismic activity, I'm shaking a building. Okay. So let's talk about this system. I'm going to write up the equations of motion because we've done these already. There we go. There are my equations of motion. Okay. I'm going to say y is a pure harmonic input. And I'm going to use our trick to say, well, if it is a pure harmonic, I know I can get to that solution just using the complex exponential form. And I can assume x matches that as well. And then if I later figure out, that y was a sine or cosine, then I just pick off the corresponding components. Yes, sir?
So we always assume that we can use the pure harmonic for the y of t?
So far. Chapter 3 will get to how to handle arbitrary inputs or combinations of harmonics. But chapter 2 here is all about one step inputs for that first section that we talked about, and then everything else is pure harmonics.
And we always assume that x of t matches.
You can here, yeah. With the exception if you use, like if the y of t is a sine or cosine and you have damping and you want to use the sine or cosine form, you have to have both to account for the phase shift. And it should be x bar. Okay. If I take that guy and plug it in, I end up with so I've just taken two derivatives of this guy, plugs it into the equation to collect the terms. Okay, I see I have either I omega t on both sides, or that. Okay. Then I can write what x bar is. So I have, and we've said before, hey, that x bar can be complex, right? We worked at the very beginning of class today. So here you see an x bar that's complex. I'll box that for now. So just to kind of give you a heads up, on exam in a couple weeks, right? You're going to get a model that's going to be a little bit more complex than this. Not a whole lot, right? And I'm probably going to ask you for the transfer function, or what's the time response, or what's x of t given that y of t is this. If you get to this point and show me all of that, you're going to get most of the credit for that part of the problem, at least. You get out to breaking it and real, and you know, to get 100% of the credit, though, we're going to have to finish up what we're getting ready to do. This tells me all I need to know. This, all the information about the response is contained right here. Okay, so let's look at the transfer function of this guy. And transfer functions can be complex, and they generally are, actually. We're generally going to look at output magnitude over input magnitude, right? Let's just look at, sorry, there's a Y bar in there. You wouldn't have gotten it right if you got to there. Still would have got most of the points, though, if you left off a Y bar. Look at X bar over Y bar. Well, that Y bar just goes away, right? And this is the a form of that transfer function. It's just kind of a complex form. And complex numbers, not difficult to understand, but it's a complex form of that transfer function. Okay. So, I'd like this, however, I'd prefer it probably to be in that form, if I can get it there, where I'm looking at magnitude and phase. All right, remember, that's what we did on the direct force case on Tuesday. So how do I get there? Well, this first term is just the magnitude of this guy, right? So how do I get to that from here? One way is, let's look at the numerator and denominator separately. If I look at this complex term, how do I get to the magnitude of that term? You guys remember? One way to think about it, if you don't remember, which seems to be most of you right now, unless you're just sleeping, or probably some combination of the two, is to think about, hey, any of these guys are just vectors on a real imaginary plane. So I can look at any complex number. Let's call it A plus IB. Okay. Well, I know that's going to be A over in the real direction plus B up. It's that vector there. Let's draw that in blue. And that point there, right? Depending on how you're thinking about it. Well, what's the magnitude of that, this guy? What's the length of that? Yeah, it's Pythagorean's theorem, right? So it's, if that's C, C squared, A squared plus B squared, so the magnitude, real coefficient squared plus imaginary coefficient squared and square root of the whole thing. The phase angle, we get to that. Yeah, right, it's this angle, right? Right, so that angle is just that. Okay, so we can do that top and bottom here. There you go. Now we have in magnitude and phase form. Okay. Well, I have those exponentials top and bottom. What can I do with those? What's that equivalent to? Right. So I'm just going to write parentheses to save us from having them. The magnitude part just comes down, right? So then I have what's happening with the two. Yeah, phi 1 minus phi 2. So now I have a transfer function that has magnitude and phase information. Minus where? No, it's the coefficient, not I. Right, so I don't take IB over here. I take just the coefficient, yeah. So, make this part explicit. That's still there, just to make sure we're following. It's written out in the notes, too. And, of course, I can divide top and bottom by omega n squared and get to some normalized version. Yes, sir? It is omega n squared, squared. Like I said, we can get that normalized version too. Divide top, yes sir.
I'm just having trouble seeing this. That transfer function is g of what? What's that name?
Omega, right? So this omega is the input frequency.
I thought it was a different.
Nope. All right. So let's look at how this frequency response looks. This gives us all the information we need to think about that. Let's look. So we're going to have a phase shift, which ends up being V1 minus V2 here, right, based on what we just did. And on top, what we're going to do is a kind of normalized magnitude. And all that really is going to do for us is let us put this 1 right here. So that's input frequency exactly matches the natural frequency, right? So that's going to be an important point for us, as we saw before. And on the horizontal axis, we'll have, right, where that's, omega over omega. So input frequency over natural. All right. So let's think about this system. We start out, we've seen this already without damping. Okay. I don't have any damping, so let's start with zeta, my damping ratio being 0. Okay. So C is 0 over here. I have a pure harmonic input. I'm pushing back and forth. What's the output doing? Tracks it exactly. Right? So if I'm plotting the magnitude of this transfer function, that's the magnitude of the output over the magnitude of the input, they're exactly tracking. That's 1. Okay. All right. What happens out at high input, high frequency? My input's really fast, back and forth. You're going to have some lag. What happens to the magnitude? Goes to 0, right? And again, the way you can kind of think about that is basically I'm pushing this thing back and forth so fast the mass doesn't have any time to respond. So its amplitude of oscillation is 0 out here. Okay. Okay. Where does it blow up at? Yeah, at the natural frequency. So my input frequency exactly matches the output frequency. If I don't have any damping, it theoretically goes off to infinity, right? So I have a plot. Looks like that without any damping. We said after that high frequency, I have phase lag. What kind of, how much phase lag do I have? At high, out at high frequency. Frequencies above my natural frequency. Yeah. Exactly out of phase when I don't have damping, for all frequencies, input frequencies greater than natural frequency. Okay. What about when it's less than the input frequency less than the natural frequency? It's exactly in phase, so we have 0 phase lag. That's the plot we drew up before, right, without any damping. Okay. Blue next. Let's add a little bit of damping. Anything change down at low frequency? Here votes for no. Yeah, I agree with that, right? If I'm pushing on this thing back and forth really slowly, it's still going to pretty much exactly track. And then the limit will exactly track. So I still have this guy here. Okay. What about out there at high frequency? Still goes to 0 eventually. Yep. What about around the natural frequency? It has a peak, thin peak, rather than that, okay? So I'm going to draw that one now, see if I can do a good job of it. Okay? The phase on these is a little bit harder to reason through because you have to kind of think in, well, what's the ratio of these guys to know, figure out what it is. So I'll give you the hint here. The phase in this case actually doesn't go to minus 180 out of infinity any longer once I have damping. Okay. Once I have damping, we actually end up going to minus 90 out of infinity. Okay. And that's due to the relationship of these two again. Right. So just still going to start at zero. And what the plot looks like, let me see how far. Pretty sharp transition. Something like that. So we have damping on these seismic inputs. Our phase goes to minus. We get 90 degrees of phase lag as frequency goes to infinity. Okay. Let's add a little bit more damping. Let's double it again. What changes? Peak's going to be a little bit to the left. It's going to be a little bit lower. Okay. Do I still go down to 1 at low frequency? Yeah. Do I still go to 0 out at infinity? I sure do. So it might look like this. Okay. How do you think the phase changes? You get a smoother transition, and then you actually converge to minus 90 faster, though. So it's this transition part smoother, kind of end up with less overshoot in phase, if you want to think about it that way, but still go out to minus 90. Let's do one more. Double it one more time. What changes? Peak goes down to the left. I still go to 1 down here. Still go to 0 out there. Okay. And we get a similar change in phase shift. Something like that. Nice pretty versions of these in the notes. Okay, you may have noticed that I did this. That's not an artifact of my bad drawing. So above this place on this plot, we see that actually having higher damping results in higher amplitude oscillation out there. That plot happens when that normalized frequency is square root of 2. Above that point, increasing your damping actually increases the magnitude of oscillation in that system. Okay. What's the... So, we're talking in pure harmonics, right? These trends, though, tell us a lot about the performance of a system to kind of random oscillation as well. So let's think about that for a second. What is the harmonic excitation frequency of the road relative to the natural frequency of your car suspension? Is it higher or lower? Which one's lower, sorry?
The road is lower.
I think some component of the road oscillation is, right? If you're talking about kind of hills and rolling hills or whatever. But what about the normal road roughness? Is that, you think, higher frequency or lower frequency than your car suspension? Higher frequency, right? You want to find the natural frequency of your car? Go push down on your bumper and get it going, and you can watch it damp out. It's kind of low, actually. Okay? And we can see why from this plot exactly. I want to be down here relative to those random road excitations so that I can absorb a small random road excitation doesn't result in large oscillation in my system. Okay. Well, actually, I want to be out here. Sorry. That's where I'm at. Sorry about that. So the road is higher frequency than my natural frequency. I want to be on this lower plot. So I actually have, that's why a sports car or truck that has a stiffer suspension, higher damping, right, rides worse than your grandparents' Lincoln Continental. That cushy suspension has lower damping. So it oscillates this out. Okay. But what's the kind of input frequency of a turning input to a system, let's say? Compare it to the natural frequency of a system. I want to turn right now. All right. So I'm out here. I want the stiffer performance, so I want to be up here. I want my input, my output to track my input. So I need a stiffer system then, in terms of damping. Right? Your car suspension is this. This is 1/4 of your car, more or less. Right? And actually, usually you'll see a model like this that represents the tire. You have one of these stacked on top that actually represents the internal deflection of the system. And you might have another one that's kind of mounts and all those kind of things. So it's stacked mass spring dampers. Can give you information about how that system is going to perform. So, yeah, when we're driving, we're out here usually. You want to be comfortable, you're going to give up performance, basically. So one thing that kind of modern automobiles do is one, you can play with the geometry and things to kind of try to start mitigating this a little bit. You're not going to get rid of it ever. But then you might have, hey, I can change my damping coefficient based on the road conditions or based on going into sport mode or whatever. That was actually some of my master's research. Right? So if I have a heavy vehicle, I did dump trucks and front end loaders, pick up some stuff, I can actively control what my damper is doing based on current vehicle conditions to try to make this curve pick out the best of whatever I want to do over there. So I can start shaping this curve based on what my current operation, desired operation bounds are. Okay. So those are position, or as your book calls them, seismic inputs. Looking at this, since we're talking seismic, I have a building, there's some seismic activity, earthquake. Where do I want to be on this curve? You think the earthquake excitation frequency is higher or lower than the buildings? Higher, maybe, I guess that depends. Vertical earthquakes are going to be a lot different than horizontally excited ones. There's some difference in those things. But what does this tell you about what your building damping ratio should be? Or your building natural frequency should be? Building stiffness. Depends, right? That's what we have to figure out. We have to figure out, okay, we have to be sure all of our excitation is falling down here. Well, then I should want high damping for sure. Right? If the troublesome excitation is out here, then I want low damping. And the other kind of trick you can play here is I start varying my spring as well, based on what I'm feeling as my inputs and current conditions. So I can start shifting this curve kind of up and down over here by changing my damper. I can start moving this left and right, right, by changing my natural frequency, by changing K on the fly. So you can figure out what your excitation is and plot yourself this curve and, okay, where do I want to land on this relative to my excitation for my given application? That tells you what K and C would need to be. Just following that a little bit? Make some sense? So even though we're looking at a single harmonic so far, right, this tells us a lot of information about how we need to design systems that are flexible or have random excitations as inputs. Right? All that information is contained right here. Questions? Yes, sir.
For
The building, you generally wouldn't. You'll see them, you can change damping. Damping is way easier to change than spring constant in general. Buildings tend to actually not, they'll pick out, okay, and we know in this region earthquakes are like this, so that tells you what natural frequency needs to be and stuff. Buildings are going to use a technique largely, like we showed on the first day, that video, that have that second mass, that vibration absorber. And a building terminology called tuned mass dampers, but it's a vibration absorber. So you add that auxiliary system that actually, that's what gets excited by the earthquake. But the buildings still do sway and take a while to settle, so pretty low damping generally. The questions? All right, see you guys next week.